any other connections you may have with friends, with your boss, with people you only get to know once a week here, for 1 week here at Holden, even a husband and wife tie can be broken. When mother and dad, if a mother and a dad are divorced and go opposite directions, even that tie can be broken. But a parent-child tie, never. Let me just give you an example. We have in our family a daughter who is adopted. Now, she has a tie with us as her adopted parents, but she also has a tie with her birth parent who lives thousands of miles away, and yet that tie is very real. And we discovered how real it is when we went to visit her birth parents and found out how strongly connected she felt with her birth mother and her birth father, even though she hadn't ever lived with them. That's just one example to show that indeed a parent-child connection is a very strong connection. Let me bring my tea over here. Okay. Well, if that connection is so important, then what happens in families must be pretty important. And that makes parenting pretty important, and it makes being a child very important. I have a friend whose main career at that point in her life was parenting. And when she'd go to visit with some other women, often they would be talking about what their careers were and were feeling very, were talking a lot about it, and oh, they'd gone to this school and they'd gotten this education and they had this doctoral degree. And this mother thought, I'm just a mother. And then she decided, that's not right. I am a mother. And that's a very important role to play. And so then she thought of what she could say when people ask her, and what do you do? And so instead of saying, I'm just a mother, she learned to say, she didn't talk just about herself. She said, my husband and I, we are socializing two Homo sapiens into the dominant values of the Judeo-Christian heritage in order that they may become instruments for the transformation of the social order according to the eschatological utopia prepared by God from the beginning of creation. And what do you do? I'm a lawyer. Well, that was an important quote for me during those 15 years when my primary task was parenting, and I had it on my refrigerator until I had memorized it from beginning to end. How about children? I needed my assistant to come up and turn on the overhead projector. It's right here. You have to push it real hard. The other way. Push it down. That's the way. Keep at it. Sort of have to push it over. There we go. And there's the footprint. This is a quotation by Henry Nouwen. Our children are our most important guests, who enter into our home, ask for careful attention, stay for a while, and then leave to follow their own way. Our children are our most important guests. That makes children pretty important. Usually we clean the house up for other guests, but this suggests, no way, what's most important are our children. And not so much getting the house cleaned up for them, but spending time with them, and all the other things we'll be talking about. Well, parents, someone has said, owe their children care. In one word, what parents most owe their children is care. And what children owe their parents is loyalty. Now, what in the world would that mean? How can parents and children be part of these
connections that go on from generation to generation to generation. Well, if you could sort of close your eyes and think, well, look at the board first. Imagine a chain link. Here's one chain, and another one, and another one, another one, and another one that goes on and on and on and on. And let's imagine that you're this one here in the middle. And the link before you is your parent. Actually, we should really have two links coming, one this way, another one, because you have two parents. This would be for mother, and this would be for father. Here's the link back to your grandparents, and the grandparents, and the great-grandparents, and the great-great-grandparents. That's one direction in which the connections go. And the other one would go this way. Here's you. Each one of us. And then there's a child, a grandchild, a great-grandchild, even if you have no children. Maybe you have a brother or a sister who has children, and they have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And so the connections go on and on. How do you get it off the board? That's a good question. We have a rag to take it off, and hopefully by the time we need it, it'll show up. Right there it is. Okay. Well, parents then have some pretty important lessons to teach, because we first learn in those homes that we grow up in, each one of us, the first lessons we learn are really the most important ones. That's where we learn either love, or we learn, if not neglect, at least indifference. If a child is treated with love, love is what she will learn. If a child is treated with indifference or neglect, that is what he will learn. There we learn to trust other people, or we learn to mistrust. There we learn encouragement, or we learn criticism. We learn to be honest with each other, or we learn deception. We learn security, or we learn to fear. We learn acceptance, or we learn rejection. Unfortunately, none of us, no parent, is a perfect parent. And so at times we give the lessons, we teach the lessons that we don't intend. We teach the opposite of what we would like. But those lessons, unfortunately, the good and the bad, get bumped onto the next generation. It's as though you bumped your lesson onto this one, and then the next one, and the next one. We call it a chain reaction. Not only that, it is even other people. Let's just go back to only one link. Let's go to the middle link that is you. And let's think about those lessons you learn at home, that you learn from parents and grandparents and so on. You have other connections. They're not as strong as this one, we said, but you have other connections with friends at school, people you work with, or if you're married, with your spouse. And those lessons we learned in the family also affect these relationships, so that if when in your home you learn to be a happy child who is secure, who is cared for, who loves him or herself, and then you go to school, and then you can learn to love other people, and you believe that you are loved by them. If on the other hand you grow up at home not able to trust anybody, and then you move into the world and you make new friends, it's hard to trust those friends. It's hard to believe that those friends will have your best interest at heart if people at your home, in your home did not. I have a quotation that I'd like to show you. Quotation by Virginia Satir, who is sometimes called the mother or the grandmother of family therapy. She says, if my past continues to contaminate the present, my past from my own family, if it continues to contaminate the present, wherever that is in my life, I can't grow. If my past is integrated with the present, then I can. Someone else has put it this way. Unreconciled relationships contaminate the present and prevent growth. It's really the same thought in a shortened form. Well, it's time then to think about how, let me just summarize then what we'd like to do in this session, and then we have some paper to do an exercise. What we'd like to do is look at that family that you're part of, especially your link, to recognize how you've been cared for, how you were given careful attention, or the lack of it, and then to see what it is that in the next generation you might want to change. So we'll talk a little bit about the present, looking at the past, and then what would we like to change in the future. We're going to begin with a picture of your family, but I'm going to put one on our board first. Now this one, it would really help if everybody could see. And I think we have all the lights on there are, so I'll try to write big. A genogram is a particular way of drawing at least a three-generation family. And when you do yours, you'll start with you and build from the bottom up. But in order to just to show you how we make a genogram, I'm going to start from the top down with a family that I think you will recognize. And when you do, maybe you can help me build it and tell me who belongs in it. Here we go. A genogram begins with parents. A line between, a square suggests a male, a man, circle a woman, and this line suggests a marriage between them, and then a line down here and the son or the daughter, whoever it is, but we don't have a child yet. This man, we'll call him Abe, and we'll call his wife Sarah. This is a husband and a wife who went on a long, long journey after they were married and before they had any children. In fact, it was a very long time before they had any children. So long, in fact, that this wife, that the wife Sarah said to her husband, maybe since I just can't have any children. Well, what do we often do if someone isn't able to have any children naturally? What do?
You usually adopt them.
Sometimes we adopt a child. Well, apparently Abe and Sarah didn't know about adoption and they had a different way of handling the problem. And what the wife said to her husband was, since I'm not able to have any children, maybe you better take one of my servants and have her for your wife and have a child that way, because I just can't have any children. So sure enough, that's what Abraham did. I think in this story he actually married her. That's not always the case, but I think he did. So we will draw a line. If they had not been married, the way in which we draw that on a genogram is to have a dotted line between them. But I think this was a marriage. And this woman's name is, does anybody have any idea what her name is? Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Indeed. Hagar?
Exactly. All right, here's Hagar. Where does this family with Abe and Sarah come from? Does anybody? Yes. Mom can help. From the Old Testament. This is a story from the Bible. And Hagar and Abe, what's Abraham's full name here? I told you.
Abraham.
they had a child instead, and that child's name was? Thank you. Ishmael. I much prefer a chalkboard, I must confess. All right. Guess who had a bit of a hard time getting along? Sarah and Hagar. Sometimes in a genogram, we show that people don't get along very well with sort of a line like that. That tells you something without words. That's what a genogram is all about. You can get lots of information without words. We could write down how old they are. We could write down how when they were married. We could say they went from Ur, that's the first town they lived in, to Canaan. You can put anything down on the genogram that you have room for. It depends on how big it is. All right. Now, after Hagar and Sarah really didn't get along very well, it's kind of hard for two wives for the same husband to get along very well. It's probably why we don't do it anymore. And so eventually there was such fighting in the family that Hagar and Ishmael left. Actually, they didn't leave until after Sarah finally did have a child. Who knows who the child finally is? Anybody? Isaac. Okay. In fact, anybody know how old Abraham was when Isaac was born? 100. When Abe was 100. When Dad was 100. Okay, we're going to have to skip some of the story, but actually it was after all of, well, one more question. Who else do you think had a hard time getting along at this point? Yes, go ahead.
Ishmael and Isaac.
Ishmael and Isaac, because their mothers didn't get along very well. The sons didn't either. So that's when Hagar and Ishmael left. All right, let's go on. Isaac finds a wife, so we build the genogram a step further. Who's Isaac's wife? Anybody remember? Isaac and Rebecca. And here's another fun thing I like to draw on genograms. Isaac and Rebecca had two sons, but there was something special about them. They were
twins.
So we draw one line and we separate it. And here we have, who's the older? Esau and Jacob. Okay, Esau and Jacob. And who doesn't get along here? Esau and Jacob. More sibling rivalry between the two. And how about favorites? Sometimes moms choose one and dads choose another. Do you know who was whose favorite? Rebecca and Jacob had a very close relationship. Esau and Isaac were closer, although the emphasis is more on this. And so they have such a quarrel that Jacob leaves, goes to another country, and finds himself a wife there. And his wife, Jacob, again, here's somebody with two wives. And a big story behind that. Jacob wants this one. And his father-in-law says, no, can't have this one. You've got to have this one first. And so he gets two. Anybody remember their names?
Leah.
Right. Here's Leah, who was older and had beautiful eyes, but didn't have as good a figure. That's exactly what it says. She didn't look as beautiful. Shape wasn't quite perfect enough. And so Leah and Rachel were sisters. And then Jacob has lots and lots of sons. Some with with Leah, some with Leah's maid, some with Rachel's. And altogether there are how many sons in this family?
12.
Very good. 12 sons of Jacob. And it does talk about one daughter, so I'm assuming there was only one daughter in the family, although sometimes the daughters are just ignored and you have to tell them the story. Well, we are coming down here to one particular son, Rachel had two sons. One of them was Benjamin, and who knows the other one?
Joseph.
And I want to bring us as far as Joseph in this genogram for a particular reason. Joseph was the one, you remember, who had that dream about having whose father, again, we have sort of favoritism here, father gave him this beautiful coat of many colors, and all of his brothers were jealous of him. And besides that, Joseph had this dream in which he told his brothers, oh, you are going to bow down to me someday. And of course, big brothers wouldn't particularly appreciate that because Joseph was one of the youngest. And one day, when Joseph went out to the field to visit his brothers, they wanted to kill him. And then one of the brothers didn't want to do that. So he says, let's sell him to those Egyptians instead. We'll sell him into slavery. So he became a slave and was taken by the Egyptians all the way over to the land of Egypt. And there he had more problems. He ended up in prison. And there again he had a dream. And through his dream he came out of prison and became one of the king's most important men, because he was the one who found a way to save the whole country from 7 years of famine. In a dream, God told him how they should save their grain for years and years and years. And then when the famine came, they had enough for everybody. And so Joseph married and had two sons. And often the names of the people meant something. They had a special meaning. And the name of this particular son was, I'm going to forget my past. Something to that effect. The past is behind me. I'm going to forget it. I don't want to know anything about my past. I don't want to remember my brothers who sold me into slavery. I don't want to remember all the awful things that happened to me back in Canaan. I'm living the good life in Egypt. That's all that's important to me now. Is that the end? You never heard of these people anymore at all? What brought his family back into his life, even though he was over here in Egypt? The same famine that was in Egypt was also in Canaan. So the brothers came to get some grain to take back home. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them right away, but he had become part of a completely different culture. So he looked different. His hair was probably short instead of long, or long instead of short, or whichever, and he wore different kinds of clothes, and they didn't recognize him at all. And so here was his opportunity to do what? Here were his brothers coming begging to him, in fact, bowing down before him. Where did you hear that before?
In his dream,
exactly. What kind of choice does Joseph have to make at this point? He has a choice to do one thing or the other. Think of what you'd like to do.
Tell them who he is.
It's one choice, to tell them who he is?
Not to tell them.
Or not to tell them. Any other things that could go into those decisions?
Well, he could choose to do something good for them, or he could choose to be really spiteful and hate them still.
Chance to get even. Chance to get even. Look what you did to me. I'm going to do the same to you. To make the long story short, he, in fact, told them who he was, and in the end, invited Jacob and the whole family to come and live in Egypt so that they would be able to survive through the famine. It's a very interesting thing that Joseph said to his brothers and his father. He said, what you did to me when you sold me into slavery, you intended it for evil, but God intended it for good. God was able to use a very bad choice of theirs and make it into something that would come for their good. It's one of the things I like about God. He's got a way of taking all our messes and making something good come out of them if we allow him to do that. So there's one very long genogram. How many generations? One,
two, three, four. Did I miss any?
All right. When you begin yours, I think it might be helpful if I would simplify by suggesting that you start at the bottom. If you have a child with you, you'll have to make two, or at least get started on two. Start with yourself, and if this is your child, let's see, what was my assistant's name?
Leah.
If this is Leah's, we need a, what's wrong? We need a circle. If this is Leah, oh, we had a Leah in our other genogram too, with beautiful eyes also. And then build it backwards to the parents. Oh, this is really bad. And grandparents. Go as far as grandparents if you can and list Leah's brothers and sisters and list her parents and her grandparents. Now, if you have some unusual, exceptional kinds of situations like the twins that we suggested, this is a sign for a separation in the family. This is a sign, symbol for divorce, two lines through it, excuse me, two lines is for a divorce. They are not married, then you use a dotted line. You can ask me if you have other questions. And we are going to take about 10 minutes to do this so that we hopefully have 15 minutes left to do a few family rules. Here are magic markers. Here are big papers. I think we may have enough. Can I ask?
I have a question here. You said something about the dotted line and the child was born.
The dotted line and what?
Married, but then there was a marriage 1 year later. What would we use for that symbol?
Yes, we would probably, excuse me, was the child born before or after?
The marriage. Yeah, before. Same parents that were living together.
Right. This is what I would do.
They got married, but the first kid, and then they got married.
Okay. This is what I would do, and I'm going to do it on a paper because I can show that better. Help yourself to magic markers, and here are the big papers.
Dark one. Bad eyesight.
I think there would be a couple of ways. Can I finish answer your question now? There are really a couple of ways you could do it. You could either have a dotted line with the line for the child, son or daughter, coming from the dotted line, and then change it to a solid line. And what I often do is have the date of the marriage right up above. So one would put married 1987, somewhere sort of where the solid line begins. Or one could simply do this and have a dotted line for living together from 78 to 81 and then married 81. It's really whatever communicates the message. Adoption. Someone asks what you do with adoption. I'll tell you what. The books say that with an adoption, you use a dotted line for the child. And because we have an adopted daughter, and that suggests to me that she's less a part of the family, I make it a solid line and simply write adopted underneath. foster children are often dotted lines as well. Right, I do the same.
But it was, once they die?
Yes, a death, yes, a death. Some people do one line, some do two lines through the square. And again, often beside the square, the circle, you have a birth date and a date for the death if the person has died.
If you know it.
If you know it.
How do you do a death?
Right. Let's say in this configuration, if it's the man who dies, then the remarriage could be put over here. On the right.
Sorry
about that. And right, if there's a divorce and then a second marriage, just build off to the side. Yes.
Say it's so good.
Okay. One line down, and then whoever.
No, just let it draw apart.
Right now, you gotta do
grandparents for your care. For what? When my dad's gone, he's gonna ruin the end of it. He's gonna be careful. He's
ruin everything. We have a question over here about my mother died, my dad remarried.
Yes.
So
that's
going to
be tricky because she had what? Because she had children also. Yeah. Oh, there are all kinds of tricky ones.
Yeah.
If nobody's going to use this, I'll use this for demonstration also. Okay, you said your mother died, your father died?
My mother died.
But right.
And my father remarried.
Right.
My Dominic has a new grandmother.
Right.
Well, the only grandmother we know is.
Mother died, father remarried. Any children from that second marriage?
No, but
no,
she had her own
her.
Children.
But she had her own children, right. I should have done this a little differently. How many did she have?
Three.
One, two, three. So there are grandchildren over here,
yeah.
As well as grandchildren for Dominic, right?
Okay.
Okay. I'll tell you what, there's all kinds of papers here you can tear one or two off that green pile. Those are scrap papers. Here are scrap papers if anyone needs more. You want one? We'll probably take about 5 more minutes to do this, and then you can finish them by yourself at home.
How do you say you showed a death and remarriage again?
Right here.
A death and remarriage was.
Here's a mother who died. And the husband remarried, so they put another line over here.
Mm-hmm.
And then are there children from that marriage?
Care about
children from that marriage as well. This was an example of where that mother had been married before as well, and had her own.
She doesn't care. The
first is just the 2 bars. Okay. Right. And then you need to draw
them. They're not there yet. They're going to be over here.
I'm not going to be able to do that.
She was married.
Yeah.
other things you could write down are birth dates, deaths, marriages, jobs.
Okay, we have a question.
Where people live. Yes, question.
Her question is, she has her circle for herself and her square for her husband and her line for her kids, but where does she put her husband's brothers and sisters and so forth?
Right.
The right of the left.
Right.
Do we put in all their marriages and stuff, like brothers and sisters?
That depends on how big your paper is and how big you want to make your genogram. Now, let me be sure I understand. You talked about husband and wife. But where to put husbands, brothers, and sisters?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here's the husband, and here are his parents. So there would be parallel lines down to the husband. Older ones to the left, and younger ones to the right. Yes, sure. If this is a husband, and we want to also show his siblings, then you begin, first of all, as I suggested, with the grandparents, or with the parents, rather, and then parallel lines down for brothers and sisters. Older ones to the left, younger ones to the right. And of course, the same holds true for the wife. Books say dotted line down for an adopted child, but since I have an adopted child and that seems like too much of an emphasis of difference between them and their siblings, I use a straight line. Foster children have a dotted line down. Okay, I'm going to ask you at this point if you would stop that so I can suggest one more activity that I'd like to help you begin, that you can also take home and finish at home. So if you could direct your attention this way one more time. All right, we started with the quotation, our children are our most important guests who enter into our home, ask for careful attention, stay for a while, and then leave to follow their own way. Let's talk a little bit more about that careful attention. We've sort of established the guests. We've made pictures of the children and everyone else in the family. Now that careful attention before they leave to follow their own way. And we want to talk just a little bit about how we teach our children in our homes. And we talk about both spoken and unspoken rules. And spoken rules would be things that you might actually hear said in so many words. Things like, say please. Say thank you. Don't eat with your mouth full. Don't sing at the table. I remember that as a rule that I grew up with. Those are spoken rules, and we learn them well if we are reminded over and over again. There are also unspoken rules that may not be said in so many words, but if you would stop and think about it, you would realize that a message is being given nevertheless. And in fact, we often say that the unspoken rules are more powerful than the spoken rules. What are some examples of those? Well, I don't think that I was ever taught in so many words, "Thou shalt not get angry." And yet, there was an understanding in the household that I, in my family's home, that being angry was really not a very good thing to do. It was all right to cry, and so I still cry before I can really show my anger. And I am still learning that it's okay to be angry, and that there are ways appropriately to show our anger. And I think there was a rule in my family, it's not all right to be angry, it's all right to cry. Perhaps there are homes where children are given an unspoken message that it's not all right to be afraid or to be sad. This message is more often given to boys than to girls. You're a sissy if you cry. Or you've got to act cool rather than show that you're really afraid that the bear might come and get you. How about arguing? In your family, was it okay if you disagreed with someone to have it out in an argument? Or were you told in an unspoken way that it's better to walk away, it's better to hide it inside, it's better to clam up or look cool? Or is it okay to argue? And you can imagine what happens if a husband and a wife come from families that have different rules. A husband has learned perhaps to argue, to have it out, and a wife has been taught to keep it inside. What happens? You know, there's a clash. The most important thing is, first of all, to understand what the rules were that the other one came with to the marriage. And understanding my own self first, not even my spouse, but understanding first of all what the rules were in my family and being able to talk about them is a most important way in terms of resolving conflict in families. It doesn't happen only between husbands and wives. It of course happens with friends as well. It happens in other relationships, whether on the job or elsewhere. What I want us to take just a few minutes to do is to write some rules from our family, the rules we grew up with. And this is the exercise where the children will need to think of a rule for their own family, and the parents will have to think of the rules from the families they grew up in. Let me just say, you might want to write down these different categories. In order to make it easier for you, I wrote down some general headings, and from those you can formulate what I call the Ten Commandments of my family. And these are the unspoken rules, or spoken, but not necessarily spoken. What did you learn in your family about money?
About what?
Money is number one. What did you learn about success? What does it mean? What did it mean to be successful in your family? What did you learn about the roles of husbands and wives? Or of fathers and mothers? What did you learn about the job of a husband, the job of a wife, the job of a mother, the job of a father? What did you learn about marriage? What did you learn, number six, about complimenting and praising? Was it okay to do that? Did you get complimented? Did you get praised? Or was there a fear that that might make you proud? It doesn't, but sometimes that's what children are taught, or what parents fear. What did you learn about sex in your family? And if you learned nothing at all, that is a message in itself. That is a rule. Showing affection. Expressing anger. And number 10, children. What was the place of children in the family? Were they to be seen and not heard? Or were children very important in the family or not? Sometimes when I draw people's genograms, when parents come who are having a great deal of difficulty parenting, I sometimes say, you know, your genogram looks to me as though it was upside down. And sometimes it looks as though the children down here have really moved up above and are parenting the parents. That happens in two ways. Sometimes if parents are very emotionally needy, then they can look to children for a listening ear or as a confidant almost, or if there's perhaps a separation or a divorce or conflict here, then children are sometimes used almost in a parenting role to be the emotional support for their parents. Or if there are not sufficient boundaries, sufficient rules that are clear and fair to the children, and the children don't feel that security, they may try to make their own rules and do their own thing. And in fact, parents feel they've completely lost control of the children. The authority has been lost, and in that way, the children become their own parents, or even the ones who set the rules for their parents. Okay, let's see. I wonder if maybe what I should do is just summarize the few things I want to say before you even go ahead to write some family rules, and then you can stay and do that here, or you can take your paper home and do them back at your room or back at your hometown. You might, after looking at the rules that your children write down, look to see how similar or how different they are from the ones that you as adults had when you were children. You might ask, which of the rules do I want to change? How many are still the same? Which have I changed? Which needs some changing? The final thing that we won't have time to talk about is what to do if, as an adult, you feel that some rules that your parents set for you as a child are still affecting you even when you don't want them to. When you go back home, how old do you feel? Do you feel like a little kid again every time you're back there with your parents? Have you learned really to do the third thing that our footprint diagram suggests to do? Have you been able to leave and follow your own way? Sometimes people try to do that without finishing their growing up, and so they may run to the other end of the world hoping to get away from those family rules, but in fact they carry them with them. Or they may think they've left because they rebel and in anger they leave, but in fact anger can tie you as closely to your parents as anything. And so we could spend, if we had time, spend some time on how to go back home and have those conversations with your parents that will help you truly let go of those ties that bind you inappropriately. And then if you've been able to leave and follow your own way, then you come back home in a new way, in a kind of adult-adult relationship, rather than continuing in the parent-child. I'd like to read one paragraph from the book that I've suggested to you that describes what that kind of maturity looks like. This person uses the term well-differentiated people as adults who have become separated from their parents in a healthy way, have been able to follow their own way, and yet stay connected to them. Well-differentiated people are able to be themselves, to do and say what they want, think, and feel without undue concern about whether others will like them or criticize them, and without a need to flatter or criticize others inappropriately.
They can be open about themselves and accept the differences of others without reacting when others try to get them to change in some way. Yet they are open-minded about the possibility of change and are able to rethink their position when new information comes in. They do not think change is an admission of inadequacy. In order to live a full, happy life, we all need to be able to be this way, particularly with our parents and siblings. The extent to which we are unable to be this way with our families is the extent to which we are still not free from their control. I'd like to close by putting up the lyrics of a song by Mike and the Mechanics on In the Living Years that talks about that intergenerational tie and how it gets passed on, and it has the encouragement to go back and talk to your parents in the living years, not to wait till they've died. Are there any questions while I prepare for the song?
What was the name of the book again? I can't really read it.
Yes. Family Ties That Bind, A Self-Help Guide to Change Through Family of Origin Therapy by Ronald Richardson.
Ronald, I would like to name you.
This is a song that was given to me by one of my clients who gave me a whole album of songs he had put together, and he calls them the Family Album. And they are a collection of all the popular songs that he has listened to that in some way relate to that have to do with family relationships. And just this past Father's Day, he gave, my watch is slow, he gave his father this as a gift, and they had one of their best Father's Day times together. All right, I'm going to just read through some of the verses because I think they're so special, and then if anybody wants to listen to the song, you can stay. Every generation blames the one before. All of their frustrations come beating on your door. I know that I'm a prisoner to all my father held so dear. I know that I'm a hostage to all his hopes and fears. I just wish I could have told him in the living years. More crumpled bits of paper filled with imperfect thoughts, and so on. There's a particular verse I want to come down to. So we open up a quarrel between the present and the past. We only sacrifice the future. It's the bitterness that lasts. And finally, the last verse. I wasn't there that morning when my father passed away. I didn't get to tell him all the things I had to say. I think I caught his spirit later that same year. I'm sure I heard his echo in my baby's newborn tears. I just wish I could have told him in the living years. Thank you very much.